You're welcome.
All right, our last case this morning, Bolden versus the Board of Regents of the University of Nebraska at all. Is council ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
You may proceed. Mr. Nehas, did I pronounce it?
Nehas.
Nehas?
I think it's like your knee and then
us. Us, gotcha. Thank you.
It's okay.
How old were you when you discovered that?
probably high school. I had two older brothers, so I had a lot to learn from. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Nolan Nehas, and I represent the appellants Nicole Bolden and Marcel Robinson, asking this court to reverse the district court's order in its entirety and remand the case for further proceedings. At this time, I would like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal.
Noted.
Reversal and remand is proper in this case, as the district court erred when it granted appellee UNMC's motion to dismiss, because the facts as pled in the proposed second amended complaint, when taken as true, established the applicability of equitable estoppel to the statute of limitations. Additionally, district court erred when it granted appellee Gardner's motion for summary judgment because there are material facts as outlined in Exhibits 5 and Exhibit 6, which, when taken in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, also establish equitable estoppel and, under Mueller v. Tott, render summary judgment improper. Turning first to the assignments of error relating to UNMC, UNMC's motion to dismiss requires that the court consider all the allegations pled as true and all reasonable inferences. And I emphasize the standard of review for the 12b6 motion because it's the reasonable inferences in the facts as pled, which is imperative to why the district court erred. The facts as pled in the proposed second amended complaint, which is found in the transcript pages 47 to 68, establish the six elements of equitable estoppel as found in Woodard v. City of Lincoln. And I want to talk specifically about the first element, the conduct which relates to a false representation or concealment of facts. In this case, the plaintiff is alleging the conduct that meets that standard is the five different representations by the State Claims Board that the claim was under review. And the reason why I point out the reasonable inferences and the facts as put is because when the State Claim Board asserts that a claim is under review, a reasonable inference is that that claim will be decided. If someone is reviewing something, it necessarily follows that that thing will be decided. And so that's the reasonable inference which results in, at the very least, a concealment of facts here. We have plaintiff's counsel first contact the State Claims Board in May, and ultimately that was when it was first asserted that this claim was under review. 9 months after that period of time, the State Claims Board had still not resolved the claim and still continued to assert that the claim was under review. And it's that 9 month period of time where the State Claims Board is asserting that's continually under review and that it will be decided. That is the very least concealment of material facts as to what the status of the claim actually is and whether it is going to be decided.
Let me stop you. So I'm gonna separate this out between what happened prior to the claim being filed and what happened after the claim was filed. So the claim is filed. It's basically under advisement, right? They have it under advisement. And when they say it's under review, that's pretty much just like it's under advisement, right? They're not saying we're going to decide it in your favor or deny it. We have it under review, right?
Yes. The statement that...
Okay. So then they have 6 months to do that,
yes,
right?
Your Honor.
So that 6 months runs, right? And even if they say they still have it under review, you have the option to withdraw the claim and file suit because they have not given you a definitive decision in 6 months.
Yes, Your Honor.
So that didn't happen here.
No, Your Honor.
Right? You or whoever from your office just let it keep going until at what point? How many months went by?
Well, and Your Honor, that is, it reached the point of 13 months after it was originally filed, so 7 months after it first could have been withdrawn. And the reason why it was the plaintiffs and or the appellants acted in good faith in not withdrawing at that time is because of the Supreme Court's holding in Collins v. State, is that if the case is decided, if the claim is decided, they have the plaintiffs and the appellants in this case would have an additional 6 months from when it is decided to file suit. And so when the plaintiffs followed up on August 13th, which is after that six-month deadline that you've just identified, where the plaintiffs first could have withdrawn, and they were told that the claim was under review, it was the appellants, the position that, okay, this claim is under review, this claim will be resolved, and then once it has been decided under Collins v. State, the appellants would have an additional 6 months to then file suit. And they
When did they say it would be resolved? They just said it was under review.
They said it was under review, Your Honor, but something being under review, something cannot be under review forever. If you're reviewing something, it would necessarily infer a reasonable inference, and that is that it will be decided.
Let me ask you a question, counsel. So what if they would have had it under review for 2 years? Is it your position that under Collins, you then get another 6 months after that 2 years?
If the case had been decided under the Collins case law, if it was under review for 2 years and then the state claims board resolved the claim and said, we are denying it, yes, under Collins, there would be an additional 6 months from when that decision was made that the appellants would have to then file suit.
Even if it's outside the six-month window when you could have withdrawn, it springs back up again? Now you have an additional 6 months?
Yes, Your Honor. That is the case law. And that is, in these situations with the Tort Claim Act, there is two rules. There's Comar and there's Collins. And Comar is that you can withdraw at the first point after the six-month period. But then Collins says if the claim is decided after that period, you then have 6 months from when that was decided. And the purpose of that is because the way the State Tort Claim Act is written, it says you have 6 months from when the claim is decided or when it can first be withdrawn. So yes, under that scenario, and that is where equitable estoppel is needed in this case, is because once the plaintiff follows and listens to the state and says they are reviewing it, we will let the tort claim process play out, and then the time passes where they can withdraw and file suit. They're stuck in a position where they cannot force the state to decide the claim to give them the additional 6 months under Collins, but they can no longer withdraw and file suit under Comar. And that is the position where equitable estoppel applies. And the reason that it applies in this situation is simply to hold the state claims board to their word. If they say they are reviewing a claim, and that means that they are going to review it and they are going to actually decide it. And at this point in time, in a 12b6 motion, the court here does not have to determine if the state claims board committed equitable estoppel as a matter of law. The court here is considering whether the facts and the inferences from those facts make it plausible that equitable estoppel would apply such that this case needs to continue to go on and these determinations need to be made at a later date.
So is your argument that just solely because they said it was under review, that's what triggers the equitable estoppel?
Our position, the appellant's position, is that by repeatedly stating that this claim was under review, that a reasonable inference is that that claim would be decided and it was reasonable, and that by stating that it was under review but not resolving in a period of 9 months taking place, that is a concealment of facts as to whether the claim was really under review and going to be decided. If in the discovery stage information comes out about what was going on in those 9 months outside of what has been pled, that can certainly be taken up at that time. But we're talking about a motion to dismiss and accepting these allegations as true to even allow us to get to a discovery phase and allow this case to actually be decided, not on simply the pleadings alone.
So under your reading of Collins, you would have been better off just waiting for them to make a decision, because then you would have an additional 6 months granted.
Yes, Your Honor. And the reason that is troublesome is at that point in time, the plaintiffs, the appellants, have no ability to force the state to decide the claim. And it results in an impossible situation where the state could feasibly hold the claim for 10 years, decide it, and then plaintiffs would not have 6 months to file suit. And that's the reason why equitable estoppel needs to apply in this limited circumstance. And I will point out that equitable estoppel has applied to the state claims board before in Lowe v. Lancaster County School District. This is not a new concept that we're asking the court to apply for the first time. And this doesn't expand the state to subject to liability in multitude of cases. It doesn't change the rules that Comar have. This doesn't change the existing case law. All this does is hold the state, when it makes representations that it's going to review a claim, or it is reviewing a claim, that it must do that. It must review the claim, and it must decide it. And additionally, I want to point out this case is distinguishable from Hollinger, which was cited in Appellee's brief. In Hollinger, the issue was the plaintiff was relying on the fact that a hearing had been set to state that that he had a valid claim. Here, the plaintiffs are not relying on the statement that they were reviewing the claim to say that our claim was valid. They're relying on the fact that they're saying they're reviewing it so that they will, in fact, determine and make an outcome on the claim. With that, I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I should have asked this before we got... This is to the appellees. I'm sorry. So there's two of you. Have you decided how you're going to divide your time?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm going to take 5 minutes, and Mr. Mooney will take 5 minutes.
Very good.
Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is Kelly Cheshire Olson, and I represent the appellee, the Board of Regents, the University of Nebraska. The District Court in this case properly granted the appellee's motion to dismiss and dismiss the amended complaint as time barred. Nebraska Revised Statutes 81-8.227 is the only applicable State Tort Claims Act statute of limitations. It provides that every tort claim is forever barred within 2 years after such claim accrued unless the claim is made in writing to the risk manager, and the time to begin suit shall be extended for 6 months from the date of mailing of final disposition of the claim or from the date of withdrawal of the claim.
Let me ask you the same question. So if the claims board would have denied the claim 2 years after it was submitted, the appellants would have 6 months.
That's correct. From the reading of Collins, if there's a final disposition, they would have 6 months. But that did not happen here. And that's, I think, plaintiff's reliance on Collins is completely misplaced.
Because they withdrew. They would have been better off waiting. So if they would have waited for the board to make a decision, then they would have the additional 6 months.
That's correct. But here they chose to withdraw their claim, and they withdrew their claim. So the timeline is set forth in my brief. But the date of the claim accrued was April 27, 2017. The tort claim was filed February 6, 2019. Statute of limitations expired April 27, 2019. The first time the plaintiff could have withdrawn their claim is August 6, 2019. So they had 6 months from that date, according to Comar v. State, to then file a lawsuit. They didn't file their lawsuit until March 31, 2020, 54 days after the six-month deadline. And when they did withdraw their tort claim on March 13, 2020. Now the plaintiffs or appellants make a statement as to this equitable estoppel argument, Your Honor, and the Hollinger case is quite instructive on this. And in the Hollinger case, the representation, well, what plaintiff is alleging, representation was that a hearing was scheduled. But the Hollinger case found that representation did not amount to any representation, false or otherwise, as to the timeliness or the merits of the claim, and that such interpretation by Hollinger was unreasonable. In the present case, the proposed amended complaint of appellant, they claimed that they were told 5 times that the claim was under review or under investigation. If setting a hearing and telling a plaintiff in the Hollinger case that that's not a representation, I don't know how telling the claimant in this case that the claim being under review is a representation, let alone a false representation.
The appellant argues that the board has an affirmative duty to decide the claim. Do you agree with that?
Well, they have is a duty to, within 6 months, make a decision or not. And in this case, they didn't make a decision within 6 months. Then that puts the onus back on the plaintiff, and they have the ability, they have an out, so to speak, to pursue their rights by filing a lawsuit. And the appellant argues in their brief a lot about the state having the power and all the power that they take away from the claimant. That's not true at all. I mean, the legislature has given the appellant, the claimant, the ability to withdraw their claim within 6 months after they first, 6 months after the claim is reviewed, and then they have an additional 6 months to file suit after it first could have been withdrawn. So there's all the power, if anything, is in the hands of the claimant to file a lawsuit. And appellants on page 15 of their brief even admit that shows that they have the knowledge, wherewithal, and opportunity to pursue their claim, because they admit when appellants inquired on August 13, 2019 as to the status of their claim, and that was right after that was a week after they could have first withdrawn their claim, that a reasonable inference is that appellants did so knowing they could withdraw and file suit. There's no excuse here, Your Honors. They waited 54 days after they could have filed the lawsuit to file the lawsuit. They were past the deadline. There was nothing preventing them from filing a lawsuit and pursuing their rights by the deadline of February 6, 2020. The other issue on appeal, Your Honors, is the appellant's motion to amend their complaint to name additional state employees, it falls under the same issue that we have here. That would also fall under the State Tort Claims Act. The same statute of limitation applies, so any amendment would be futile. With that, Your Honors, I would ask the Court of Appeals if you could properly affirm the granting of the motion to dismiss of the lower court. Thank you.
Thank you. Hold it there. Thank you. Welcome back, Mr. Mooney.
Good morning again, 2 days in a row. May it please the court. Bob Mooney, I represent Polita Gardner in this matter, and given that I have 5 minutes, I first welcome any questions. A short argument today.
So procedurally, I'm going to unpack something here for a second.
Yes.
The court converted the summary judgment, but the second amended complaint hadn't been filed. The motion hadn't been ruled on. The court didn't need to convert to summary judgment because it's on its face, Gardner as an employee of UNMC and the statute of limitations that was just talked about on its face, they were entitled to a dismissal on its face.
No.
Fair statement?
The trick was the plaintiff's original complaint, actually it's an amended complaint, they amended once before we ever knew about it, but the first amended complaint alleges Kalita Gardner was an employee of UNMC.
Exactly.
That's an incorrect statement.
Right.
She's actually an employee of Nebraska Medicine.
But even if it's incorrect.
Yes.
Even if it's incorrect as to when they filed it on its face, if it's too late, the court could have just dismissed the lawsuit even if she was an employee of UNMC as alleged because it's filed too late as alleged.
Arguably, yes, because of all that you've just heard in the prior 5 minutes.
Right. So if they could have done that without converting the summary judgment, the next step then is the motion to amend to add the additional stuff as it relates to the equitable arguments, because that wasn't in the original complaint.
Correct.
Okay. So then we get to the standard of a motion to dismiss, which is, would it survive a 12B6, right?
Correct.
So we don't really need to get to the whole summary judgment stuff here, because summary judgment wasn't necessary.
Arguably correct.
Okay. That's what I want to make sure first.
We had to file it as a fallback, because if the court takes every statement in their complaint is true, then it's left with solely the impression that Kalita Gardner was an employee of the UNMC.
Right.
And at that point, UNMC had not moved for summary judgment, filed their motion to dismiss. So we filed it as a motion to dismiss or in the alternative summary judgment, and then you consider all of our affidavits that establish she's not an employee and the filing is a year too late.
Right. And on this record, it becomes relevant at that point because apparently that's what triggered them to now want to add Nebraska Medicine, replete it, add the equity allegations and the like. And now the court needs to look at that and say, should I allow them to amend or would that be futile?
Correct.
Right? And the standard by which the court needs to look at that is whether that proposed second amended complaint would survive the 12B6 motion to dismiss.
Yes. Okay. And it would not, because Kalita Gardner was not an employee of UNMC. She was an employee of Nebraska Medicine as a private citizen and private employed person. You had to file it in 2 years, and they didn't do that. So then you get to this equitable estoppel argument, which is specious, because their equitable estoppel arguments all focus on the notion that something that Kalita said to the plaintiff prenatally, you know, about you should do this at UNMC was the sole information that they could then rely on when after Namara passed, they had a year, 2 years to investigate the veracity of who they should sue, and they're excused from doing any investigation because Kalita made this statement during the prenatal.
So if you add it all together and take it as true, the combination of them saying that Gardner told her that she worked for UNMC. They go on the website and they see at least some connection between Gardner and UNMC. They're pursuing a state tort claim. They file a notice of claim. Now, at some point, everybody becomes aware, internally I would think, that they're suing the wrong party. Under those circumstances, with the various representations, the things that are going on as alleged, do they not state at least a basis for a claim in equity for tolling?
No. Because
why not?
Because it requires a misrepresentation be made by the defendant. The equitable estoppel only exists to prevent mischief by a defendant from lulling a plaintiff into a false sense of security and prejudicing their timeliness of their filing. That's the six-element test. But one of those elements is that a misrepresentation was made. UNMC doesn't have an affirmative duty when that claim is presented within the 2 years to say, hey, wait a minute, she doesn't work for us. They get 6 months to review. They're not under an affirmative duty to correct the plaintiff's misapprehension. That's not what equitable
tolling requires. But if Gardner made the misrepresentation and she's actually an employee of Nebraska Medicine, at some point, don't one of those two have an obligation to clear up?
It's one element. Even take that as true, okay? We would obviously dispute that and we would deal with that in the discovery.
Understand.
But take it as true.
Right.
You still have five more elements that you have to meet, and one of those is a lack of ability on the part of the plaintiff to discover the facts being true, the true facts.
The reliance component?
Absolutely.
But don't get into a fact situation there when the allegations are, Gardner specifically said, I am employed at UNMC. I read the badge as being a UNMC employee. Aren't we talking about fact questions enough to get by a 12B6 motion?
No, because you're looking at statements that are made before the delivery of this child, before there was ever even a claim in anybody's mind that there might be a claim for malpractice. What did they do after the claim for malpractice? In the record, there's a reference that the medical records of Ms. Bolden say UNMC. Those aren't in the record. They didn't put those in the record. That's hearsay. It's irrelevant. What did they do? The billing statements that we put in all show Nebraska Medicine. Did they get a release of records and get the information? Did they ask anybody? They're simply saying, she told us months before Namara was born that she was employed at UNMC. Ergo, we can rely on that for 2 years after this baby dies and do nothing else to dispel us of that notion. And Kalita can't use that in her defense. She is prevented. That is the mischief that they're trying to rely on. That's not mischief on her part. She didn't say this after the claim arose
to
prevent them from
trying to. But add them together. So if, you know, again, recognize these are allegations.
Sure.
But we have to take them as true as it relates to this stage, right? If Gardner had misrepresented she worked for UNMC, and she is an employee of Nebraska Medicine, and the stuff on the internet and or whatever they found as it relates to why they were pursuing it. But then couple that with the fact that now, affirmatively, Nebraska Medicine and Gardner know she's pursuing a political or a state tort claim action. At some point then, based on the representations early in connection with knowing that she's going the wrong way based on it, doesn't Nebraska Medicine at least, isn't there a fact question as to whether they have an obligation to clear that up?
No, because you got to remember, Nebraska Medicine is a private corporation. Completely separate and apart from UNMC. The statement you just made presumes that when the claim was presented to UNMC, that entity over there, that somehow Nebraska Medicine or Kalita Gardner would be aware of that. They weren't. The evidence in the record is Kalita Gardner first became aware of this in April of 2020 after suit was filed, and somehow it processed through some mail office at UNMC and landed on her. That's 3 years after this baby was born. That's the distinction. Is Nebraska Medicine, you can't presume Nebraska Medicine knew what UNMC knew. They're two separate entities.
Well, Gardner is an employee of Nebraska Medicine, as it
yes.
turns out. So she learns of the claim being filed against her, albeit in the capacity of UNMC. Right? Is there a fact question?
She learned when the suit was filed in March of 2020. And candidly, I got to be honest, I don't know how she learned. It filters back through. I mean, I get a sign from Dave Popper, the risk manager at UNMC. Hey, will you go defend these? I'm sorry, I misspoke. Risk manager at Nebraska Medicine. He calls me and says, go defend this. And I look at it and say, well, she wasn't properly served. She never got served. She found out about this somehow, I assume, through the risk management folks at Nebraska Medicine when they see one of their employees is sued for malpractice. We come in and we defend, and we properly did so. This was akin to a voluntary appearance. You didn't have service, and that brings up the jurisdictional question of whether you even have jurisdiction to hear this based on the lack of proper service and the expiration of the 6 months. But back to your question, you can't presume that Nebraska Medicine knew what UNMC knew when the claim was made.
Well, it's a fact question standard, right? So Gardner, who turns out to be an employee of Nebraska Medicine, she learns in April of 2020, which is when she got served, which is in the same month that they tried to affect service, that she's being sued, in her capacity as being an employee of UNMC. And then it unrolls from there. And then right. they're pursuing the state tort claim. They're going down that line. Doesn't that at some point state a fact scenario by which, well, your answer is going to be the same. The answer is your position is not.
No.
That's what we have to wrestle with.
Do you have anything else? Okay.
Okay. All right, we took him over way too long.
Thank you, Your Honor.
How far did we go over?
4 minutes and 18 seconds.
How about two? Would you like the 2 minute rebuttal?
I would say at least a 2 minute rebuttal.
All right. Okay. Let's do that.
Thank you, Your Honors. In the interest of time, I will note the service argument. I would refer the court to our briefs and why due process was met and service was valid, and the case law in there establishes that it was reasonably calculated to apprise her of the situation. Judge Welch, you made a very valid point. This was a factual dispute. There's at this point in time regarding Appellee Gardner, there is a factual dispute as to what's going on in this case, and that at least needs to proceed on to discovery and allow that facts to be determined. At this point, the court shouldn't be determining the facts of whether it was proper, should not be determining the weighing the competing facts to determine whether who she was employed by.
Once the claim is filed, what duty do the other parties have to come forward affirmatively and say there is misinformation in the claim?
I think the appellant's position would be that there is a duty by UNMC to, when reviewing, or by the State Claims Board, when they're reviewing this claim, to note this person named, one of these people named in the complaint, is not even a member of the state.
And where does it say that? What statute, what regulation, or what case law supports that?
I don't think there's any case law that I have seen that states that UNMC has to come forward, but I think that relates back to this idea that if they are reviewing it and actually reviewing it and deciding it as they represented they were, those would be decisions they would, things they would say rather than just sit on the claim and say they're reviewing it.
They have a duty to review the claim and either accept it, reject it, they can do nothing. So that, and again, I come back, where does it say they have an affirmative duty to let the claimant know that there's misinformation in the claim?
I don't know of any statutory basis that would assert that they have a specific duty to allege defects. However, in Lowe v. Lancaster School District, where equitable estoppel was applied, it was done because the State Claims Board did not notify the plaintiffs of the defect in the person that they had filed the claim with. So under that case, it would be reasonable to say that they would have some duty to identify the defects. And I see that I'm out of time. May I just briefly conclude?
Wait, let me throw something out there, though. So they may not have an affirmative duty to tell, but if they don't, then the principles of equitable estoppel are going to kick in. Is that what you're saying?
I think that if they are alleging, the appellant's position is that if they are affirmatively stating they are reviewing the claim and there is a defect in the claim that they are not stating, that is at least a concealment of facts which warrants the application of equitable estoppel and at least warrants this moving past a 12b6 motion.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome, Your Honor.
Very good argument on both sides. We appreciate you being here. We will take the matter under advisement, and you are excused. And we are adjourned.
Yeah.